On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, we've obviously been talking about the GAA a lot so far this hour on the show, but next year will also mark a fairly landmark anniversary for the GAA because it will be the 50th anniversary of the first annual Congress to be held in Ulster. And it was also the first of the GAA's annual Congresses to ever successfully pass the ditching of Rule 27. What is Rule 27? Well, you've heard of Rule 21, the ban on participation if you're a member of the British Security Forces. You've heard of Rule 42, the ban on the use of GAA grounds for foreign games. Rule 27 was more just correctly known as, or more colloquially known as, the ban. Donal Fallon, what was the ban?
Well, I mean, we've had some, as you said, some real GAA heroics in recent weeks.
Don't be so smug.
Was it ever in doubt?
Actually, for quite a sustained period yesterday, it turns out it was actually.
Indeed. And fair play to Mayo. They definitely put it up to the dubs in the first half. But we're looking back further than yesterday.
Yes, the ban.
I think it's worth saying, you know, rumours of the GAA's demise have been greatly exaggerated. And, you know, those who supported the ban maintained that if it was ever to be removed, the game would just collapse across the island of Ireland. And you know what? I think recent weeks and recent months prove that isn't true, that the infrastructure of the GAA in this country is so incredibly strong. And the soccer association football is the most popular sport in Ireland by participation levels, you know, across the island of Ireland. But I don't think anything touches the GAA when it comes to organisation. And it would seem today, you know, at the remove of half a century, that, you know, the fears of some people in that room in Belfast in 1971 were totally unfounded. But what I like about the ban is that the story touches on some of the most remarkable names in 20th century Irish history. You know, Dougláthas Na Hida, Douglas Hyde, the great Con Martin, brilliant footballer, brilliant soccer player. But it also allows us to talk about, you know, some people who followed on from it and have spanned, you know, remarkable careers across several sports. Kevin Moran, I know you're a Manchester United fan, the great Kevin Moran, and the brilliant Jason Sherlock. But, as you know, we talk about Rule 27, but on one level, it was always just simply the ban.
Yeah, if you haven't picked it up at this stage, the ban obviously was a ban on members of the GAA from participating in other sports, the so-called foreign games. But it actually went further than just a ban on participation.
Yeah, it dates from 1905, and it's been kind of largely misunderstood as a ban on the playing of foreign sports by members of the GAA. But in truth, it was more significant because it actually outlawed the attendance of GAA members at foreign sports matches. So you couldn't go and watch soccer. You know, if you live next door to Dalymount Park or Milltown, you could never grace the terrace. And you couldn't even participate in social gatherings that were organised by other associations. So, you know, forget your local dance in the soccer club hall or anything like that. And the rule says
that's how exhaustive it was. You couldn't set foot on the premises.
Yeah, it's as much about social interaction as it is about sporting interaction. And the wording of the rule is any member of the association who plays or encourages in any way rugby, football, hockey or any imported game which is calculated to injuriously affect our national pastimes is suspended from the association. But that's pretty ambiguous in its wording, I think. You know, speaking of any imported game which is calculated to injuriously affect our national pastimes. What about sports which, you know, one could argue weren't? You know, there were other sports too. So as we learned today, even when the ban was in place, you had like curious episodes like, you know, exhibition games of baseball that were played in Croke Park.
Muhammad Ali fought in Croke Park. Is that a foreign game?
Yeah, and I totally blanked that actually when I was putting this together. Muhammad Ali in Croke Park. So I think you can better describe this as a ban not on all foreign sports, because what are boxing and baseball, but imported sports. But it's much more a ban on what's perceived to be the threats. You know, what are the games that are in the community?
Yeah.
And that nasty old term, the garrison games, you know, the games with British connotations and afoot in the country, especially in urban areas. And really, to be honest, if you want to break it down, I think it's fair to say it applies particularly to one game, and that is association football.
Yeah, which is all the more remarkable when you go back and look at the wording of that rule, because if you're banned from playing rugby, football, hockey, or any imported game which is calculated to injuriously affect our national pastimes, like it gives you the impression that these games were only brought into Ireland to try and rebuke the growth of Gaelic games, which you might argue, you know, on one level is true because Gaelic games existed for centuries upon centuries, but Gaelic football was only codified by Michael Cusack himself and by Maurice Davin and the others who founded the GAA. So although there was a kind of a kickball sport, there wasn't really any codified Gaelic football in the sense that we know it now. Like, rugby existed in an organised level in Ireland before Gaelic football did as a codified sport. So the idea that rugby was this sport that was, you know, imported to cause injury to the Gaelic games is a kind of a weird one. Almost immediately after independence, so we're talking the 1920s onwards, this rule was introduced in 1905 and already it was on the firing.
Yeah, I mean, if Rule 27 is understood as a barrier, you know, against the Anglicisation of Britain or of Ireland or whatever, you want, or whatever you want to call it, when Ireland makes the break with Britain, when there is an independent Irish state established, people begin saying, well, can we take down the bricks of this wall now? You know, has it done its job? Mm. Can it go? And really from the early 1920s onwards, with the achievement of an Irish state, some people are really questioning Rule 27. And David Toms, the sports historian, he says that delegates from various county boards sought to have the rule ended in 1924, 1925 and 1926. So imagine that year on year at the GAA's conferences in the 20s, this thing is being brought up. Yeah. But they remain firmly, and they come primarily from the more urban counties, but they're very much in the minority camp.
I suppose it's reminiscent of Rule 42 and how they needed multiple congresses to get that one over the line as well back in the noughties. Talk to me about enforcement, because obviously this must be a challenge, because if you are a GAA member, how can you be spotted if you are attending a game or even attending the premises of another association unless there was a fellow Gael there to see you do it?
If Rule 27 existed today, people would probably out themselves on Instagram, you know, by tagging themselves into photographs in Tala Stadium or Daily Mail Park.
That's the 1930s snitch tagging.
That's one thing we've learned from COVID-19 restrictions in Ireland. You know, people will always out themselves in the end. But in a time before modern technology, you know, when you couldn't put up the video of yourself on Instagram, how could you enforce it? And it was a really old-fashioned way. The so-called vigilance committees were needed to enforce it. Literally, men that would be dispatched to Dalymount Park or Lansdowne Road as the eyes and ears of the association. And I've always thought to myself, if you were a GAA man who liked association football, you liked watching soccer, would you not just nominate yourself to go onto the vigilance committee?
Yeah. And you could go along with your comedy moustache and your fake nose.
As many games as you want. But Dublin Opinion, which was a great kind of humorous publication in the 1930s, like the Charlie Hebdo of Irish politics in the early 20th century, they had a great cartoon of Detective Keenan, member of the Garda hurling team, who wears a fake beard to sneak into Dalymount Park. And then the inimitable sports writer and broadcaster, Brendan O'Hare, brilliant man, brilliant voice. He later recalled the fear of the Vigilance Committee. He remembered them, and he was a great GAA man, O'Hare, but he remembered them trying to spot their straying sheep among the graceless goats. So you can picture yourself standing on a terrace watching a game of soccer and trying to spot these Vigilance Committee men in the mix.
I love the idea that you'd be so distracted, like you're doing this crazy run down the right wing to try and get a cross in for someone else to put it away in the 6-yard box, and then your eye is caught as you're dashing down by the fella from the local committee who's looking at you to make sure that you've actually broken your own cover. Just in case people do think that this was a rule that only existed in paper and that it was never kind of really enforced, this was enforced, and never in a more high profile instance than when the head of state himself was removed as a member of the GAA.
Yeah, I mean, an extraordinary man, Douglas Hyde, Douglas Dahida, and very much the kind of the embodiment of the cultural revival in the early 20th century. And I think someone who was seen as being above party politics, hence he becomes the first president of the new state. But he had praised the GAA in a way that no one else had really during the revival. He said that the work of the association in reviving our ancient national games of Camogie or hurling and Gaelic football has done more for Ireland than all the speeches of politicians. So, I mean, he is someone who has been a champion of the GAA. And the fact that, you know, the founder of the Gaelic League, the president of Ireland, is the patron of the GAA is enormously important for both bodies. But then in the 1930s, 38 to be exact, Hyde attends a football match between Ireland and Poland in Dalymount Park. And that leads to his expulsion from the GAA. And it really shines a light, I think, on Rule 27. In many ways, it's the kind of beginning of the end. And later on in his memoir, the Polish council to Ireland, kind of like the Polish ambassador to Ireland at the time, remembered that it was all kind of his fault. He said he was an arsonutron with his wife. And he says, during the conversation, I addressed the president as casually as possible. I wonder, Mr. President, would you kindly accept our invitation to the Irish-Polish football match? Of course I will, answered the grand old man. And do send an invitation to Mr. De Valera as well. I'm sure he'll also accept. And they went along. You have this great picture of Douglas Dahida, De Valera and Oscar Traynor, you know, 1916 veteran, Fianna Fáil minister and president of the FAI. So I'm sure Traynor loved the fact they'd got Douglas Hyde along to a soccer game. Mm. But the presence of Hyde at that match causes tremendous controversy. And my friend Cormac Moore, lovely book, lovely title, The GAA versus Douglas Hyde, writes about
that's how a Netflix series waiting to be made, isn't it?
It's a brilliant title for a book. Writes about how this all played out. But I think the point that Cormac makes very well in the book is that it was the beginning of, it was so ridiculous that someone as respected and as adored as Douglas Hyde was put into the firing line by this rule. And then when baseball is played in Croke Park in the early 40s, the point that's made in the newspapers is, well, they should have invited Douglas Hyde to the baseball game instead, you know, because this whole scandal would have been avoided.
Is worth remembering at the time, by the way, that in the 1930s, at this time that Douglas Hyde went to an Ireland soccer match, it was Ireland. It wasn't the Republic of Ireland, and the Ireland team claimed to represent all 32 counties. There was two of them on their rounds at the time, so it was a slightly more politically charged time, but even still, the president showing up to a soccer match and getting expelled from the GAA is quite another thing. The quiet hero of this tale is a man called Tom Wolfe. It's a name who isn't really much remembered today.
No, not at all. And Cormac kind of praises him as particularly important to the story. He's a Kerry man, but he's the chairman of the Dublin Service GAA Club, the Civil Service GAA Club. And he had this experience in 1948 where there was a brilliantly talented young player suspended for playing a foreign game. And then that player, who Wolfe had to confront and say, you know, we know you've been playing soccer, basically takes no further part in GAA activities ever again. So, you know, Wolfe finds himself thinking, what is this going to do other than drive brilliantly talented young people away from the association? And as Moore puts it, Wolfe was disgusted by the experience and refused to ever act as vigilante again. So he starts a nationwide campaign within the GAA and very much playing out in the media throughout the 50s and the 60s. And he brings in, you know, very respected players, All-Ireland winners, sports journalists, people who felt the same. And he fights this thing, you know, over the columns of the national media. And the counterclaims are just extraordinary. You know, one man condemning Wolfe on record says, the ban should be retained. Men like Thomas Davis, Pádraig Pearce and Wolfe Tone died for its retention. Now, definitely.
Wolfe Tone died for its retention.
In 1798 in a prison cell.
That's
in a barracks.
That's contentious.
It is contentious. But Moore's book kind of makes the point that the world was evolving and changing. And for all the talk about Wolfe Tone and 1798 and everything else, it was the modern age. I mean, you couldn't enforce the ban anymore. How can you tell people not to watch foreign games when the 1966 World Cup is literally broadcast into people's homes in Ireland? I mean, the barrier, the walls, if you will, were coming down culturally as much as anything else.
The idea that if you go channel hopping and suddenly you come across Jeff Hurst hitting the crossbar in Wembley, that's it now, you're out
in
the
rear yourself.
On the subject of soccer, and you've already mentioned a couple of them, there were more than a few great players who were then lost to the other game.
The brilliant Con Martin, Dubliner Con Martin, Mr. Versatility, because he could play anywhere on the pitch. And you have to remember that if someone makes the leap from Gaelic games to soccer, that gives them a unique advantage over most soccer players in that, you know, Con Martin was a very capable goalkeeper, a very useful goalie. But he helped Dublin to win a Leinster title 41. And when it was discovered he was playing soccer with drums, the great Drumcondra, the great lost team of Irish football for me, Drumcondra, he's expelled and his medal is withheld. And he doesn't get the medal, the 48 medal, until 71 when the ban is lifted. He played for Leeds, Aston Villa, Glentoran, then very unusual
for
a Dubliner to play for Glentoran in the mid-20th century. It was unheard of. But, you know, more besides in a great career, and he's an example of someone that was lost, because I firmly believe there were enough hours in Con Martin's day, he would happily have played Gaelic football and association football if he could.
Speaking of Tom Wolfe's whole campaign, by the end, when we get to the first Congress in Ulster in 1971, has the battle been won at that stage?
It's such an anticlimactic ending. 30 county boards backed the scrapping of the ban. We won't name the two who didn't, but 30 county boards backed the scrapping of the ban at this meeting in Belfast. And I think there's something beautiful about that 1971 GAA conference that happens in Queen's University, Belfast. You know, it's kind of a sign that, that things are changing, if you will, slowly but surely on the island of Ireland. So that was something to celebrate in itself. But yeah, the removal of the ban, after all that work by Wolfe and other people in taking down the bricks, it's gone. You know, almost as quickly as it's introduced, it has just faded from the record.
And then when there is no hindrance to them playing multiple codes, then this clears the path for the likes of Kevin Moran and the likes of J.O. to do what they do.
Yeah, what an iconic figure, Kevin Moran. You know, he's part of that kind of decade of the Dubs, the Heffo's Army team.
The first of the two decades of the Dubs.
The first of the two decades of the Dubs. We're definitely living through another one. Wins an All-Star. Plies his trade with Bohemians as well simultaneously, and then, you know, he's spotted by the great Billy Behan, who's Manchester United's kind of legendary chief scout in Ireland, and he becomes a Mancunian.
Goes on to become the first person sent off in an FA Cup final in 1985.
Yeah, and a Mancunian legend now in his own way. But it's probably fair to say the name most synonymous, I think, in recent times with sporting versatility in Ireland is Jason Sherlock. I mean, a very crucially important Dublin player, part of that 1995 All-Ireland winning team, but a League of Ireland stalwart, top scorer with Rovers in his first season there, and even playing basketball. And I don't know if it's urban myth or not, and I'd love to hear from J.O. on it, but it's said that in one weekend he played for Rovers Dublin and a game of basketball in Talisman.
Just where would you have the time? Just seriously, it's unreal. But I mean, it's very impressive how some of them are able to perform at the highest level. Kieran Donaghy is involved with basketball in Tralee as well, and just how he can play at the elite level in both. Lee Chin, a couple of years ago, not only does he still play inter-county senior for Wexford in football and hurling, but then at one point in the latter days of a season, also togged out for Wexford Youths in the latter days of a League of Ireland season to try and get them promoted to the top tier. Incredible stuff. So that was Rule 27. That was one ban, and it fell away nearly half a century ago. Some of the other bans that we mentioned lasted quite a bit longer.
Yeah, Rule 21, which read, you know, members of the British Armed Forces or police shall not be eligible for membership of the association. That applied to the RUC, the British Army, and once upon a time, actually, to the DMP, which was kind of particularly controversial.
So but it came the year ends just as it started with us talking about the DMP.
We can't get away from the DMP. But that came into being in the 1890s and remained until November 2001. You know, it was only with the birth of the PSNI that one was removed. But there are one or two examples, they're not big names, but there's one or two examples of people who won All-Ireland medals and later joined the RUC and were expelled from the GAA. Rule 42, famously in the news in recent times, the playing of non-Gaelic games in GAA stadiums. That wasn't so much scrapped as modified. You know, it allowed soccer and rugby in Croke Park during the redevelopment of Lansdowne Road.
And we saw the whole hubbub in Parky Cueve, and they wanted to have the Lee Miller benefit game there a couple of years ago as well.
Absolutely. But, you know, as I think we should end on a very positive note. I mean, what we've witnessed in recent weeks, I think, what there is in the GAA is there's something remarkable. I mean, I didn't think we'd see an All-Ireland final this year, to be honest.
Yeah, and we
did. And there's so much good there. And it's a pillar of the community. You know, it's a world-class sporting offering that we have. But I think what's been proven with time is that, you know, Rule 27's core belief that the GAA would be negatively impacted to the point of its existence being in doubt if the ban on foreign games was dropped, well, that's been totally proven to be ill-founded.
Yeah, I'm sure at some point they apologised to Douglas Hyde, although you never know. You really never know. Donal, thank you for this contribution this week and ever. Fascinating stuff and always so timely. Appreciate all your contributions. We'll see you next week for the twist of a special. But in the meantime, happy Christmas to you and to yours. And thank you very much for coming in. Donal Fallon is a historian. He is the author of the Come Here To Me books and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast.